But today we're coming towards nearly the conclusion of our series on questioning Christianity, which is we're trying to look at what we all long for and desire out of life, a secular, materialistic worldview offers, and then what Christianity uniquely offers. And today we're coming to our desire for joy, or beauty, or something in that ballpark. In the 2015 movie Room by Lenny Abramson, has anyone seen that movie? Room? Well, it's a powerful movie, but emotionally exhausting to watch. It's the story of a young woman who's been kidnapped and when she was a teenager, and then she's held hostage by the man for 7 years, and she's kept in a room, forced to become his consort. 2 years after she's kidnapped, she's then she becomes pregnant and gives birth to a son. And the movie actually opens up when the son is just about to turn 5 years old. And unsure of how to psychologically explain their predicament to her son without just totally, you know, crushing him, she tells him that everything that exists in the room is real, but there's actually nothing else outside of the room. And so the boy's whole universe is that room. And they have a little TV in the room. And she just tells him, like, what you see on that TV isn't real. It's in the TV. And so he comes to reason out, everything that is in the room, this is my world. This is real. And what I see, you know, rivers, mountains, people on the TV, that's not real. But then at a certain point in the movie, the mom realizes that she needs to escape. To do that, to make the escape happen, she needs the little boy's help. But first, she has to convince her son that actually there is a world outside of the room. And that what he has seen on the TV, ice cream and mountains and birds, that is real. But the boy becomes very confused and very angry and says, no, the room is real and the TV is fake. There is no world out there. And it becomes this tragic predicament where you see that the boy is having to have his whole world deconstructed in order to bring about this rescue escape attempt. And it's a great parable. You know, this is a parable that's served itself actually in many different forms. And in another way, this is kind of Plato's allegory of the cave. But it's this idea of, is our world essentially limited to what we see with our eyes, or is there a world beyond what we can experience through our sense experiences? And that's what the little boy is needing to find out. And that's a great picture of how we can think about life. Is life essentially a 10-foot by 10-foot room of what we see with our eyes? And again, the room is a fitting analogy, because often when we look around at this world, what do we see? We see difficulty, suffering, disappointment, sickness, death. Just if you have your eyes open, this world is full of hard things to believe in. And there are people who say that, no, there's more than what your eyes see. There's a God, there's a heaven, there's truth, there's beauty. It's beyond what your eyes can see. And so I want to think about those just two ways of thinking about the world. Is the world essentially only what your eyes see, or is there something beyond? Is this all there is? So we want essentially to believe that there is more than what our eyes see, more than the grim realities of disappointment, suffering, and death. We want to believe that in the end, the hero wins, that happiness will always rule, that everyone will go home together smiling. But wanting to believe something to be true doesn't make it true. I may want to believe that I have a wealthy uncle somewhere who I don't know about at this point, who is going to leave me a massive inheritance. But if I were to go out right now and go try to buy a Bentley or a Rolls Royce based on the hope of a wealthy uncle, you would all obviously say, that's very foolish. That's a silly thing to do. Simply wanting something to be true does not make it true. And when we look at life, we realize that there's actually not a great deal of evidence that tell us that life has something more than what our eyes see, that there's more than the grim reality of life, death, burial. So one author, John Shavir, he's a Pulitzer Prize-winning author, he says that, quote, the main emotion of the adult American who has all the advantages of wealth, education, and culture is disappointment and discontentment. So we live in the wealthiest, most privileged culture that probably ever walked the earth. We have more information, more resources, more healthcare, more benefits and conveniences and entertainment and technology available to us than any other human being has ever had access to. Right? The poorest person in America has wealth and riches infinitely more than many of the other poor people around the world. And yet, with this embarrassment of riches, our primary emotion, this author is saying, is disappointment and discontentment. We're just not happy. We're frustrated. We're bummed out. You're sad when your iPhone is slow. Right? That in itself is a great parable of what he's talking about. So, for us to retain a belief that there is a satisfaction, high beauty, and joy appears to be something that leaps over the data in front of us. If rich Americans are whining about their iPhones, then what is our hope of actually finding happiness? Matthew Arnold was a poet living in the 19th century, and he was not a Christian. He was an atheist. He rejected any supernatural faith. And he pinpoints this idea that a belief in beauty, joy, meaning, satisfaction, it essentially is tethered to religion and faith. So I'm going to read a poem. If you don't like poetry, follow along in the notes, and you can see if you can make sense of this. He writes, and this is his poem, The Sea of Dover. The sea of faith was once, too, at the full, and round earth's shore lay like the folds of a bright girdle furled. But now I only hear its melancholy, long, withdrawing roar. So just pause. What is he saying? The sea of faith, mankind's belief in God, was once full. So full and so shining that it was like it was overflowing out onto the world. But now, and he's writing this in 1864, but now, he's saying, all he hears is the sucking out of the tide of faith, draining. He goes on, ah, love, let us be true to one another, for the world, which seems to lie before us like a land of dreams, so various, so beautiful, so new, hath really neither joy, nor love, nor light, nor certitude, nor peace, nor help for pain. And we are here as on a darkling plain, swept with confused alarms of struggle and flight, where ignorant armies clash by night. It seems like, this is what he's saying, as we look out on the world, maybe it seems to give you an appearance of beauty, of meaning, but really, that's just the residue of faith. That's all that is. And when you take the mask of faith off, what's behind the world? Well, there's no light, there's no joy, there's no love, there is no certitude, there is no peace, there's only pain and darkness and ignorant armies clashing by night. It is a painful world. The world is hard. Every parent who has ever leaned down to their child and said, life is hard, they're taking, you know, an approximation of what Arnold is saying here. Saying, hey, if you think that life is going to be simply just rainbows and lollipops and good stories, you need to realize that life is going to be filled with just terrifying heartbreak. That's what you need to know. speaking of the salvation of Jesus Christ, Arnold wrote, "Never let us deny to this story power and pathos," pathos meaning like a emotional power to it, "or treat with hostility ideas which have entered so deep into the life of Christendom. But the story is not true. It never really happened." So in other words, Arnold is saying, the story of the gospel is a beautiful story. It resonates emotionally, but it's not true. It's not real, right? Before C.S. Lewis was a Christian, he was talking with J.R.R. Tolkien, his friend, and Tolkien was trying to convince him that the beauty of myths are there to try to kind of reach into non-Christians and to draw them into the true myth, which is the story of Jesus. And Lewis, he's a skeptic. He just responded back to him saying that myths, of course, are false, though. And so they're worthless, even though they're breathed through silver. So maybe the story's really pretty. Maybe you can weave together a fanciful tale about meaning and significance and identity and community and justice. That's great, but it's just not true. Religion may be able to give you beauty and transcendence, but what if it's not true? If there is no God, then what is true? I've found no better summary than Bertrand Russell's brief little paragraph from his essay on the free man's worship. Bertrand Russell was an atheist who was willing to pay the full price of his atheism. So here's what he writes. "Man is the product of causes which had no prevision of the end they were achieving. That his origin, his growth, his hopes and fears, his loves and his beliefs are but the outcome of accidental collocations of atoms. That no fire, no heroism, no intensity of thought and feeling can preserve an individual life beyond the grave. That all the labors of the ages, all the devotion, all the inspiration, all the noonday brightness of human genius are destined to extinction in the vast death of the solar system, and that the whole temple of man's achievement must inevitably be buried beneath the debris of a universe in ruins. All these things, if not quite beyond dispute, are yet so nearly certain that no philosophy which rejects them can hope to stand. Only within the scaffolding of these truths, built on the firm foundation of unyielding despair, can the soul's habitation henceforth be safely built." That last line, you may say, well, how is that safely built upon that? What he means by that is you won't be deceived. Everyone reads Bertrand Russell there and you say, yeesh, geez, man. I don't want a cup of that. But he's saying that you're missing the point. The point isn't that the truth is nice or makes you feel good. This is just the truth. You come from nothing. You're going to nothing. Your life means nothing. That's the truth. And if you don't want to be deceived by hucksters, you need to build your life on that firm foundation of unyielding despair. That's what he means. Now, I want to suggest to you two things that sound contradictory. Here's the first thing I want to suggest to you. I think everyone in this room has had enough experience in life that has led them to see at least a sliver of truth in what these authors are saying. Many of you have experienced hard things, pain and disappointment and malaise and boredom and suffering. And there's a truth to that fact that hey, life is really hard. It's not like life is just a vending machine of happiness. Often it's brutal. It's hard. What did Thomas Hobbes say that life was? Solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. Okay, that's a bit exaggerative, but still, we've had enough in our life where you've had someone be cruel to you, someone you trust has hurt you. Right? Dreams and ambitions that you had have turned out to not happen. You thought you were something, and you turned out to not be that, right? So there's something in you, I want to suggest, intuitively says, I see how someone could say, oh yeah, life isn't happy. Life's hard. But I also want to suggest something else. That there's something inside of you that when you hear Bertrand Russell and Matthew Arnold describe this life, there's something else inside of you that says, no way. Life is not like that. You've experienced moments in life that have led you to say, there's no way that could be true. The English philosopher Sir Roger Scruton, assuming the sir means he's been knighted. I don't know what it takes to be knighted, but I'm assuming that means he's kind of a big deal. Here's what he writes in one of his books. Anybody who goes through life with open mind and heart will encounter moments that are saturated with meaning, but whose meaning cannot be put into words. These moments are precious to us. When they occur, it is as though, on the winding, ill-lit stairway of our life, we suddenly come across a window through which we catch a sight of another and brighter world, a world to which we belong, but which we cannot enter. I think that you all know intuitively that you're not stuck in a 10 by 10 room. Or even if you feel like you are, you know there's more. There's a world out there. So let's look at the idea of there being more, that this world and what your eyes see is not all that there is, but there's more. Okay, here's what I want you to do. Consider your favorite memory. I don't know if you've ever tried to think that way. Just try right now. Think back. What's your most precious memory? The sweetest moment that you have, that you cherish. What did you experience when all of the circumstances clicked into place for you and life handed you something precious? Something you wanted to use almost maybe the language sacred? A moment that seemed to reach down elbow deep inside of you. Grab the very knot of your being and yank it down deeper into you so that you experienced a depth and a profundity to a moment that you had yet experienced. I can think of a couple of those moments in my life, right? You know, massive moments, you know, my wedding, watching my bride walk down the aisle, holding my firstborn son for the first time. But let me just pick something more basic so that you realize that this isn't only tied to like serious life events. I think when I was about 18 years old, I was taking my little sister on a birthday trip to Seattle. And we were going to an event that was that night, so we had woken up in the dark of the morning and had left. And as you're driving in, I mean, many of you have probably made this trip, right? After you get past Yakima and Sela, you enter into this like barren wasteland of nothing for a long time. I mean, it's just this long, empty space where it's just tumbleweeds and dirt and dry ground as far as the eye can see. But just outside of Ellensburg, before you get there, you go up this long, big hill, and then you come up over that hill, and it's like God spilled a bucket of green paint down the hillside. You know, the grays and the browns just click off, and there's this pool of green ahead of you. So we're making this drive, and I have to have made this drive before that, but the sun was just rising, and so we come up over this hillside. I remember the radio, the song that was playing on the radio. It was White Winter Hymnal by Fleet Foxes is playing, and I was so taken aback by the scene that I pulled over, and I stepped out. The air was crisp and cold. I could look out and I could see just little dots of farmhouses as the golden sunlight just spilled down into the valley. And just a sweeping experience of transcendence came over me. An emotional awe and profundity that I knew in that moment, there is something big and good and glorious, and it's like I've I've stepped into it for a minute. And I've never been able to recreate that experience, though I've been back to that hill and I've driven over it several times. There's a scene in The Hobbit where the dwarves and Bilbo are going through Mirkwood and they're lost and they're hungry and it's dark and they don't know if they're going to get out. They're hopelessly confused. But then they see off in the distance a glow of light and they smell food. And as they approach closer, they see that elves, you know, these high angelic beings almost, are having a feast. But as soon as they step out to join the feast, whew, the lights turn off and the elves disappear. So I think we have had moments where it feels like we have stepped into like an elvish feast. We've walked into something that was not made for us or we didn't come from, but we feel like, I want this more than anything. And it's intangible. It's hard even to explain because it's fleeting, right? The sunlight only lasts for a little bit. The song only lasts so long. Eventually you finish the book. Eventually you have to move past the waterfall. Eventually the conversation dies down. It only lasts for a bit. And then it's gone. And you can't just get back to it that easily. C.S. Lewis makes a shocking suggestion. So C.S. Lewis eventually comes to faith, right? And he thinks about this desire maybe more than anyone else. The books or the music in which we thought the beauty was located will betray us if we trust to them. It was not in them. It only came through them. And what came through them was longing. These things, the beauty or a memory of our own past, are good images of what we really desire. But if they are mistaken for the thing itself, they turn into dumb idols, breaking the hearts of their worshipers. For they are not the thing itself. They are only the scent of a flower we have not found, the echo of a tune we have not heard, news from a country we have never yet visited. So Lewis's provocative idea here is that those moments of transcendence, of beauty, of feeling like you've stepped into something wonderful, it's actually not found in the thing itself. That's why I can drive back up to that hillside now, stand in the exact same moment, I could turn the radio back to the Fleet Foxes song, I could wait till sunrise, and I wouldn't be able to recapture it. It's not in the valley. Like, and whatever the moment is for you, it's not actually in that thing. They're not containers, they're windows. And these windows simply appear at certain moments, right? Like the children in the Narnia Chronicles, like they just are swept up into Narnia different ways without their control. It just comes unbidden to them. Now, Lewis, in his essay, goes on to point out a problem, and this is the problem of that's built on that idea that these moments are fleeting. We remain, he writes, conscious of a desire which no natural happiness will satisfy. So we have these flashes, these moments of beauty and joy, which are so wonderful, that we're filled with a longing that's almost painful. We want that so badly. But here's the dilemma. We cannot satisfy this craving. We have all sorts of cravings that we can satisfy, desires for food, for sex, for adventure, but we cannot satisfy this. One of the chief problems of mankind is that we confuse our desire for the transcendent with one of the things that was the window through which it came. So we assume that it was the meal, the food, it was the sex, it was the adventure, the experience that contained the joy, that was the beauty, but it isn't. You can't recapture the wonder of the moment just by simply getting it again. And that's why it is rare and disappointing. So it seems we're bound to a perpetual disappointment, not because we lack good or stimulating experiences, but because we long for what is essentially beyond that experience itself. And so Lewis goes on speaking about that transitory, that fading experience of that transcendent joy. He says, for a few minutes, we have had the illusion of belonging to that world, the world through the window. Now we wake to find that it is no such thing. We have been mere spectators. Beauty has smiled, but not to welcome us. Her face was turned in our direction, but not to see us. We have not been accepted, welcomed, or taken in to the dance. Right? You get what he's saying there? So you get caught up in a really good book, right? You know, and it just, you want so badly to be in that story, but you can't. Right? What do we want? We want more than that. And so he goes on, we do not want merely to see beauty, though God knows even that is bounty enough. We want something else which can hardly be put into words, to be united with the beauty we see, to pass into it, to receive it into ourselves, to bathe in it, to become part of it. That's what we want. And yet, it's impossible. But and that in itself is what leads someone to a perspective of nihilism, to someone like a Matthew Arnold to say, there's no point. See, the only way that you can live in this world of high beauty and transcendence and vaulted kind of fantasy is if you're just deluded. But that actually, the frustration of it, C.S. Lewis uses to make one of, I think, the most provocative arguments for the existence of God. So let me lay the argument out for you in the form of a syllogism. So this is, Peter Kreeft is a Catholic philosopher, and he's put this into a helpful syllogism. Premise one, every natural innate desire in us corresponds to some real object that can satisfy the desire. Premise two, but there exists in us a desire which nothing in time, nothing on earth, no creature can satisfy. Conclusion, therefore, there must exist something more than time, earth, and creatures which can satisfy this desire. Okay, that's in your notes, right? You can follow that argument in your notes. Let's take each premise at a time. So premise one, every natural innate desire in us corresponds to a real object that can satisfy that desire. So this isn't talking about artificial desires or externally coerced desires, right? Just because I desire a rich uncle doesn't mean I will have a rich uncle. Natural and innate desires are desires that are found in all persons, regardless of their culture or conditioning. And so you may want to believe that you could fly like Superman, but that's not a natural innate desire to a human being. What are natural innate desires? Well, here's, Lewis goes on, a man's physical hunger does not prove that the man will get any bread. He may die of starvation on a raft in the Atlantic. But surely a man's hunger does prove that he comes of a race which repairs its body by eating and inhabits a world where eatable substances exist. In the same way, though I do not believe, I wish I did, that my desire for paradise proves that I shall enjoy it, I think it a pretty good indication that such a thing exists and that some men will. A man may love a woman and not win her, but it would be very odd if the phenomenon called falling in love occurred in a sexless world. So do you see the logic of what he's saying? If you fundamentally have a desire for something transcendent, and that is an innate natural desire of all human beings, then the only way that you should have that desire is if there is a transcendent reality which that desire corresponds to. Premise two, Kreeft says that there is nothing in this world. There is nothing in time, on the earth, and creatures that can satisfy that desire. Right, and this is just appealing to the common experience of human beings, right? So King Solomon, in the book of Ecclesiastes, has, he gives himself over to every possible pursuit of pleasure. And what does he find? It's meaningless. It's pointless. And like, and if you read Ecclesiastes, you realize like he's not just giving himself over to women or to drinking. I mean, he gives himself over to like sophisticated pleasures, you know, architecture and education and morality. Like he's not just, you know, going to Las Vegas and blowing a bunch of money. But yet he finds out that it doesn't matter what you do, you're gonna die. And when you die, that's it. There is nothing, he argues, under the sun which can satisfy you, right? And that's, and if there was something that could, man, we would know about it, wouldn't we? Jean-Paul Sartre, the atheist existentialist, says, there comes a time when one asks, even of Shakespeare, even of Beethoven, is that all there is? So, Lewis's conclusion, there must be something. If I have within myself desires for a transcendent reality, there must be something transcendent. He says famously, creatures are not born with desires unless satisfaction for these desires exists. A baby feels hunger. Well, there's such a thing as food. A duckling wants to swim. Well, there's such a thing as water. Men feel sexual desire. Well, there's such a thing as sex. If I find in myself desires which nothing in this world can satisfy, the only logical explanation is that I was made for another world. Now, that is a great argument for theism in general. But let me just push the lever a little bit towards the uniqueness of Christianity. The uniqueness of Christianity isn't just that there is a transcendent realm, an afterlife, a spiritual world. Right? Thus far, anyone of any religious persuasion could be tracking with me. Right? All I've done thus far is show that our intuitive existential experience makes it obvious that a life where we are pure materialists, as in there's only the only thing that exists is matter, what your eyes see, doesn't make a lot of sense. But what does Christianity uniquely offer? Christianity uniquely offers the fact that the God who is in that transcendent realm has actually come down to us. He has pushed through the curtain of this earth, and he has come in the person of Jesus Christ, the Lord of glory. And not only that he has now bought our salvation for us by his own death, and he has set before us this glorious future where we will be welcomed in. A land of transcendent realm, beautiful and glorious, right? We all want that. Yet the reality is that if there is a God, a personal God there, then what does he think about us? Christianity does not leave you to speculate, does not leave you to wonder, does not leave you to sit and to think about, well, gosh, what about the bad things I've done in my life? There is an impersonal God who answers and who deals with your sin and who has come to you and has laid before you just infinite promises of glory for you. Listen to this last line from Lewis. At present, we are on the outside of the world, the wrong side of the door. We discern the freshness and purity of morning, but they do not make us fresh and pure. We cannot mingle with the splendors we see, but all the leaves of the New Testament are rustling with the rumor that it will not always be so. Someday, God willing, we shall get in. That's what Jesus has come to offer, a welcome in to the world that we long for so badly. Okay. Now, the reason why we've been doing these talks is I've been trying to give you, one, just one of the great benefits of apologetics is it just kind of helps strengthen our own faith. When we see that there are good arguments for the faith, and there's good reasons to see how weak maybe some of the counter-arguments are, that's just spiritually edifying and encouraging for ourselves. But also, the larger reason why I'm wanting to do this is to provide you opportunities to think about how to talk with skeptics or people who are questioning Christianity. So what I've been trying to do is just provide, you know, hey, here are these big issues, and here's kind of how I try to approach this with unbelievers. This argument is probably my favorite argument to use when I'm talking with a non-Christian because it's intuitive, right? It relies so much on just your felt experience. Everyone feels and experiences that reality that, yeah, life's hard and disappointing. Yet we chafe at it. Yet we feel like, man, it shouldn't be this way, right? I shouldn't be disappointed. I shouldn't be heartbroken. I shouldn't have to say goodbye to those who die. Right? There should be a happy ending. And so I think this is maybe one of the best places to start when I'm talking with someone. And so when I'm talking with someone who's not a Christian, I'm always trying to look for opportunities to appeal to their intuitive recoil at that hard ugliness of the world and that sense that, like, man, I feel like I wish things were different, and their positive longing for more. I want glory. I want beauty. I want transcendence. I want to be welcomed in. And I'm always looking for opportunities to just kind of hop onto that and then point in this way. Beauty is intuitively experienced, right? Like, it's, you don't need a logical argument for why a sunset is beautiful, right? I don't need a scientific explanation for why a bouquet of roses smells pleasant and is pleasant to look at. So that's why this is if you feel particularly intimidated about talking with non-Christians about, like, their arguments, or maybe you have a non-Christian in your life who's just, like, smarter than you are, and you feel intimidated to talk with them, this is a great place to go, because it's going around maybe some of their rational defenses and appealing to that kind of emotionally intuitive part of them where they sense, like, yeah, I feel like a kid who's been locked in a 10-foot by 10-foot room, and I feel like there's a world out there. You can come in and say, there is, and it's far better than you ever thought. Really, in a lot of ways, this is just talking about the hope of heaven. That's what this is talking about here. Okay, let's take the rest of our time then to go through some questions. If you have any questions, in response to that, if there's anything you want some clarification on, or if you were imagining what a skeptic might say in response, take the rest of our time to maybe interact with those.
The current situation with AI, Arnold's statement about it, the story is not true, it never really happened,
yeah,
is being lived out in this current situation with AI. If you've heard or followed, there's a lady called Karen, whom you can have a relationship with through AI. She's not real.
Mm-hmm.
And there are, I forget, I heard a number today, there are like 15 or 25,000 people are in relationship with her through AI, and there's a waiting list that's greater than that. So where I'm going with that is the despair of the philosophy of Arnold and others somehow causing people to want that kind of thing, even though they know it's not real? I don't know if I could even express it, but I thought about that one.
Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah, I mean, I think that's evidence of despair, great despair. If you're willing to have a relationship with something that is essentially, you know, not a human, then, I mean, what a great tragedy. That sounds like a dystopian, you know, scenario.
And what hope do you have? No hope.
Mm-hmm.
The reality of the concept of true relationship.
Yeah, I think
God has created us
See, but that's what I would... Human beings, like, human nature is malleable, right? Like, you can... You know, if you grew up in a society where it was normal to kill a person of a certain race, and you saw that happen in front of you, like, your nature would be warped. Yet there still would be... Like, you still are made in the image of God. So, like, our society, through an incredible amount of coercion and force, whether that's through deprivation or intoxication, whether, you know, it's Brave New World or whether it's 1984, like our human nature can be warped, but we are still made in the image of God. And so there is still going to be something inside of us that is going to feel the hollowness of that. You know, like someone who's in a, if I was talking with someone who is saying like, yeah, I have a hard time making relationships work, so I just have a relationship with this robot that, yeah, I think I would try to capitalize on the fact that, like, I know that that's not going to be satisfying, you know, because human beings are made in the image of God, because God is inherently relational as a triune being. That means humans are inherently relational. So we're made for relationship with each other. So that's the benefit of, again, I think I've said this before, but like we always have home field advantage in the fact that like we know what truth is. Even if someone, you know, in this argument, it's an appeal basically to their desire, people's desire for satisfaction, and the assumption that unless you are finding satisfaction in God, you are going to be unsatisfied. But of course, someone could come back and say, I'm not unsatisfied. Like, I'm very satisfied with my life, with my robot girlfriend or whatever. And at that point, like, all we can do is we can make an appeal to them. Like, this argument isn't like a logical proof, even though, you know, I laid it out in a syllogism there. But this is rather, we're saying, I'm appealing to the image of God in you. You have a longing, right? Ecclesiastes tells us that God has put eternity into the hearts of men. There's something in them. They're longing, they're reaching, they're stretching. They may be turning to an AI girlfriend out of a desire for that. You know, I think it was Augustine who said, every man who goes through the door of a brothel is really just looking for God. We're made for God. And so when we don't worship him, we turn to what Lewis said, to dumb idols, right? And so we think, oh, here's where the joy, here's where the beauty is. And we try to find it there. So but we have the truth. We know where the bread can be found to feed hungry people. And so we can appeal to them, but they might say, no, I'm not hungry. I'm happy making mud pies. And at that point, we just appeal to truth and then what else can we do?
So I've been trying to figure out how to word this. So it might be a little long-winded. I'm sorry. I guess a group of skeptics, I've always had a challenging time broaching the subject of Jesus with those, I don't know if it's the right term, but self-religion, mm-hmm. like manifestation.
Yeah.
Like, I was here and I went through dirt and crap and all these things, and I manifested this certain type of lifestyle, and I'm living it, and I've mm-hmm. healed myself, and maybe they're not, like, it's only me, myself, and I. They have community, they have great morals, values.
Yep.
You know, outside it looks great, and so it's kind of, I guess, similar to what you're saying, like, that idea, like, I am happy, like, I don't need anything else. So it's, like, almost how do you, like, keep walking in relationship with someone mm-hmm. who has that self-manifestation, self-religion kind of mindset and isn't, like, why would I need Jesus when we know, like, he's the ultimate satisfaction, but they haven't reached that kind of conclusion. They want to keep, like, manifesting their lifestyle, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's such a great question. Yeah, this argument would probably not be very effective. And they would say, like, yeah, that's why, a lot of people who are in that New Agey religion, they... You know, some of them are from Christian backgrounds, but a lot of them are from, like, secular atheistic backgrounds, and they found that, like, wow, that was really bankrupt, and I feel emotionally starved, and so they turn to that, and it gives them all the benefit of religion without the cost in so many ways, right? It's a life force is something that you can manipulate, because God's not personal, right? He's a force and a power for you to harness for your self-actualization. What this argument would do would just show them that coming to Christianity doesn't come at the expense of your desire for the noumenal, for the transcendent. And that's what they're hungry for, right? Okay, totally, we get it. Like, there's a reason why pagans for thousands of years have worshipped trees and rivers and mountains, because we desire to look up at those moments and to... So this would just come along and say, you're not losing that in Christianity, but what you don't have in the self-actualization is that you have no means of atonement, right? So even if they say, you know, sin is what my fundamentalist parents and evangelical friends foisted on me, and I've learned to accept and love myself for who I am, and I don't need those old categories, that's fine for a bit. But wherever you go, there you are. And like, you can't outrun your own guilt. You can push the beach ball underwater for so long, but it's going to pop up eventually. And when it does, if you're your own messiah, your own guru, then it's up to you. And right, and this is the same predicament of the Pharisees. Right? If you are your own savior, if you're justified by your works, then while you're on top, you're very confident, right? And I'm sure many of the people that you're thinking of are very confident in their righteousness. They know that they're righteous, and they probably have great morals in many ways. The fascinating thing is that what do you do when you fail? What do you do when you fall? Right, and because eventually they will. Eventually they will not keep up even their own standards. Right, and that Romans 2, Paul says that Gentiles have the law of God written upon their hearts. They don't have the Bible, but yet that law will accuse them on the judgment day. Like, they have a sense of, like, I don't even keep up my own standards. You know, Francis Schaeffer said that there's an invisible tape recorder hanging around the neck of every human being, and it switches on every time you give someone else advice. And at the last day, God is going to just take that tape recorder off, and he's going to play it, and he's going to judge you according to your standard. That's what I would appeal to there. What do you do when you fail? How do you treat people that you disagree with? How do you treat people that don't abide by your own standards? And then I would just talk about the uniqueness of Christianity. I have several friends who are of that mindset. I remember talking with them once and telling them that I was confident that I was not a good person. And they looked at me like I was just I was mentally unwell. You know, they said, "What's wrong with you? You are a good person, you know?" And their assumption, they read back into that, like, this is the problem with Christianity, is that you have this negative, self-deprecating view of yourself. Like, this is what a doctrine of sin does. And it just, I was trying to explain to them, well, no, you don't, you're totally misunderstanding it. I realize that I'm not a good person, yet I am totally accepted by my Savior. It's just not on the basis of what I do. And so God accepts me for who I am, not off some lofty idea of who I think I will be. And like, right now, like those friends, they have an idea in their own mind of how good they think they are. But eventually reality is going to catch up with them, and they're going to realize, oh, I can't even keep up my own standards. And it is just thin soup to tell yourself, I just have to learn to accept myself and love myself. Right? Like, you know, there are some sociopaths out there who can do that, but not many. We all have a standard, and we all struggle with that. And so I think eventually that guilt's going to eat them up. And so I appeal to the uniqueness of Christianity. We have, I mean, there's a lot more to it. A personal God. That would be good. But I would probably focus in on the uniqueness of our personal God, who is a God who atones. Great question. Stephen, did you have something?
hunger, we eat food. It's a temporary satisfaction. How do we know that when we get to the transcendent, that that will be a fulfilling in perpetuity?
Like it won't be like hunger, like, oh, we got it now.
Right, now I'm hungry again.
Yeah, that's a great question, Stephen. So Jonathan Edwards, his sermon he preached called Heaven is a World of Love. Edwards is hard to read, so I would never recommend it. I would never hand Jonathan Edwards to a non-Christian. Like, read this, and it'll make sense. But I would rely basically on his argument there. And his argument is that because God is eternal and perfect and infinite and ineffable, ineffable just means, like, you can't even fully describe. That means that we will spend all of eternity plunging deeper and deeper into God. And every time that we think we've hit the bottom or that our capacity for joy has been satiated, our capacity will simply grow because God will never end. And he talks about in the sermon that it'll have like a compounding effect, because the more that you plunge into the heart of God, the more you will see of him, and the more you'll see of him, the more you'll love him. And then, so then the more you love him, the more you will be drawn into him, and on forever. You know, we have just a dim picture of that in marriage now. You probably love Laurie now more than you did on the day you were married, right? You know, even though at the day that you were married, you guys were like, wow, our love is full. But yet now, time has gone by and you've realized, you know, there's a depth to it. But you're sinners and your hearts are clogged with sin and you mess up and you're creatures, you're limited, you're finite. What would it be if Laurie was infinite and perfect? Then, how long have you been married? 15? 15 years? Okay, and the way that your love has grown already in 15 years with you being limited, sinful people, what's 15 years in heaven going to be? And then what's 15,000 years going to be? And on and on. So Edwards will say that, and that's why heaven is a world of love. It is an ocean that you will never reach the bottom of. Okay, we're after our time, so we'll go ahead and end there. If you have any other questions, I'd be happy to answer them, but let me pray. Well, Father in heaven, God, we're so grateful that we're just not left to speculate. We're not left with just foggy longings for a transcendent something that we don't know. But God, we know the Lord of glory. And we know that our deep longing is located and fixed on a person that we will spend forever with. God, we long for that day. Oh, we long to see your face and to have this great ache of our heart be healed. So come soon, Lord Jesus. Bring your kingdom. In Jesus' name, amen.